When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hi Chris, how are you?
I'm great, thanks Farah. What have you got for me in today's quick fire round?
Today we're looking at the world of tech and innovation. Are you ready?
Let's go for it.
Snapchat or TikTok?
Can I say neither? Obviously, because I work in media, I'm incredibly familiar with both. So
you're literally trying to bullshit me right now, Chris.
I'm never off Snapchat. We're inseparable.
Great. Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos?
I think Elon, first name terms, obviously, me and Elon. I just think he's just a crazy genius.
Bill Gates or Steve Jobs?
I think Bill Gates. I think Bill Gates is a genuinely remarkable man. He's the greatest philanthropist there's ever been. And he's not just giving money away, I say just, but the scale of his ambition that he wants to achieve with that. And you know what? You kind of think he might just succeed.
Apple Music or Spotify?
Spotify. I think Spotify is a genuinely, fabulously thought through product that I use all the time.
Sheryl Sandberg or Mark Zuckerberg?
Sheryl Sandberg. First of all, she's done it twice. I mean, she transformed Google and then transformed Facebook. And I just think she's a real international icon.
And finally, Silicon Valley or the famous Silicon Roundabout?
It's a tough one, but I'm going to go Silicon Roundabout because I live about 5 minutes away and there's a great kebab shop on the corner. And I'm sure they've got lots of stuff going for them in Silicon Valley, but have they got a great kebab shop?
Even though I said it's famous, most people probably won't know what that is. So you might need to tell our American audience what the Silicon Roundabout is.
Well, a kebab shop is somewhere where they... No, Silicon Roundabout is London's equivalent of Silicon Valley, which is literally a roundabout in East London with apparently some tech companies around it. I don't know whether there even are any, but that's the rumour.
And just before we get to the episode, it's worth noting to our listeners that this was recorded earlier this year in February, before the coronavirus pandemic disrupted all of our lives and the UK went into lockdown.
Hello and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership podcast, powered by Intelligence Squared. I'm Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, and in my day job, I'm global CEO of Havas Creative Group. Leadership is difficult but not complicated. In this podcast series, I want to help you cut through the bullshit and get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by a different inspirational leader who is doing just that, leading change in their worlds of business, technology, sports, or politics. Today's episode is with the Wikipedia founder and internet pioneer, Jimmy Wales. Jimmy Wales is one of the most influential leaders of the internet age and perhaps the most successful Silicon Valley entrepreneur to not become a billionaire. He experimented with crowdfunding before it was a thing and even came up with Deliveroo before they did. 1.5 billion devices access Wikipedia every single month, and it's not an exaggeration to say that across the world, Wikipedia has changed the way we access knowledge. Welcome to the podcast, Jimmy.
Thanks for having me.
In three words, describe your leadership style.
Friendly. I try to be thoughtful and lazy.
Brilliant. Yeah, very good. No, not that surprising. I've got some sympathy with that. If you could delete any word from the business or leadership jargon dictionary, what would it be?
Crowdsourcing. I can explain why. Crowdsourcing.
Yes, please do.
Crowdsourcing comes from the word outsourcing, which is all about thinking about where do you find cheap labor. And if you think of your community around your work as cheap labor, you've got it all wrong. It's about finding out what they want to do and support them.
Which leader do you most admire, present or past?
I don't think I can single out any one in particular. I can single out the type.
Yeah.
I like a leader who is very thoughtful and slow and reflective. So basically, if you think of Donald Trump and then imagine the opposite, that's who I like.
Okay. I wondered if we get Trump in there somewhere. And what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
I was very sensitive as a child. And if somebody said something that hurt my feelings, I would be very upset. And my father said, you shouldn't care so much what other people think. And I'm like, okay.
Well, you've certainly stuck with that.
I've stuck with that, yeah. That's good advice.
Your parents know best.
Yes.
And final question, what's the best decision you've ever made?
I think the best decision I've ever made, and I used to say this in two ways. So I think the best decision I've ever made is to put Wikipedia into the nonprofit structure. But I used to say it like this, it's the best decision and the worst decision I ever made as a joke, because now I'm not a billionaire. But I stopped saying that worst part because people would take that far too seriously. Oh, he really regrets not being a billionaire. It's the worst decision I ever made. I'm like, you know, it's a joke. Like, it's the best. Trust me.
So what does a billion hits a month feel like?
It's an amazing thing. I mean, every month we see 1.5 billion devices. And that's not necessarily 1.5 billion people, because probably you see Wikipedia on your phone and on your desktop computer, you know, so two devices. But we still think it's probably 600, 700 million people every month. So we're part of the infrastructure of the world, really, now. It's something people rely on whenever they want to know something.
So for reasons you've just explained, just about everybody's familiar with Wikipedia, because we're all visiting it all the time.
Yes.
I'm guessing most people, or many people, will be less familiar with WT Social. Do you want to tell us a bit about what that is?
Yeah. Well, WT Social, Wiki Tribune Social, is my new project, new platform. The concept here, and I can go on quite a rant about what's broken.
Please do.
About the
Please
world.
Do. Well, my next question was, does the world really need another social media business? So
yes,
that might be a
yes,
good,
it definitely
a good segue.
Does. Well, I started this project a couple of years ago, realizing that something's terribly wrong with the news. You know, we see the rise of low-quality media, clickbait, headlines, real fake news, which is a thing that does exist. It's not, you know, Donald Trump calls everything he doesn't like fake news, but there is a real phenomenon. And I just thought, you know, I need to figure something out here. I think everybody has a responsibility to say, look, something's wrong in the world. Let's try and fix it. What is the environment that's causing that? That's what we need to fix. There's nothing wrong with journalism. Journalism is great. There's great journalists out there. It's the media that they're working in. And so for me, this is where the real realization is, that the advertising-only business model of Facebook and Twitter in particular, because they're the ones who most deal with news. Obviously, there's other social platforms, but their business model is to show you as many ads as possible, to keep you engaged, to keep you clicking, which leads to a design.
I'm not sure that ads keep people engaged. I mean, I work in advertising. People spend a lot of time trying to avoid ads.
Yeah. And I'm not anti-advertising.
But the point is,
no, it's not necessarily the ads, but they want to show as many ads.
Yes, that's for sure.
Right?
They do,
yeah. And obviously, I mean, from their perspective, they want you to pay for the ad. So it needs to have some return for you. That's
yes.
good. But they'd rather somebody just look at your ad and then stay on Facebook, right? And not go off and engage with your amazing creative thing. Anyway, the point is that in that environment, what they want to optimize is for people's time on site, which leads to optimizing for clickbait headlines, for fluffy content, for shareable viral things, because that's what keeps us addicted, even though there's another part of our minds that says that's not really what I want. People are, you know, familiar with the mail online's their layout, where they've got whatever sort of screaming headline story they've got here, and then they've got their sidebar of shame, as it's called,
yep.
which is all celebrity fluffy nonsense and lots of bikinis. There's always bikinis there. And that's because that's what people click on. And so I said, look, what if we had a different kind of social network where everything is optimized around content that the community, a community very much like the Wikipedia community, has decided is quality. Like, these are quality things that you should read. These are things that you're going to find interesting.
Is it a news site or a social site or something new that we don't, the like of which we don't quite have at the moment?
It's something completely new, I would say. So it is primarily a social site. We say it's a social site focused on news, but it's an unusual social site. So every post, or nearly every post, is collaboratively editable. So the idea is, like, I can post something and say, oh, here's a good link to the Center for Disease Control's article about coronavirus and their current thinking about that. And then somebody else can come and say, oh, well, here's actually a similar one from the UK. And you can build something together to say, here's a reference to this news topic. We've launched with no ads and no paywall. So a series of bad business decisions, but that's how I've built my career so far. And the idea is to say, look, we can find a different model for social media. And so the model I'm learned from and created with Wikipedia is to say, look, pay for it if you want to. Like, there's a place. We do ask you to pay. You don't have to pay. And what I want people to think about is, what does that do to our incentives? So inside
Our incentives, social, as in within your organization.
Within the organization. Society, so yeah. For my incentives. So with WT Social, the fact that we don't have ads and we don't have a paywall means, wow, the only reason you'll pay is the same only reason you pay for Wikipedia, is if you say, you know what, this is meaningful. Like, this is something that I think should exist in the world. It's made my life better. I should chip in. I believe in this. And that's a very different incentive from my incentive if I say, how do I get you on the site for 3 more minutes a day?
And are people doing that in large
numbers? Yeah, we've had a huge success. I mean, I was hoping to see 1 out of every 200 people pay. That was my back of the envelope estimate, that if we got that, we would be able to go forward. And it's a lot better than that.
Wow.
It's good. Now, time will tell, right? First of all, this is the early adopter crowd. So this is people who know my work. They're interested. They think like I do, that, hey, I do think something like this should exist. I'm happy to chip in to help Jimmy try to realize this. Whether we can grow beyond that, where we have not 500,000 people, but 500 million people, and we still see 1 out of every 200 pay, to be seen.
Can I take you back a few years? When did you first realize the revolutionary potential of the internet? And I suppose, obvious follow-up question, has it lived up to or down to your expectations?
Yeah, I mean, actually quite early on. I remember back at university, I joined a politics discussion list, and I sent an email to someone, and then they responded that they were in Australia. And I was like, wow, Australia, you know, I'm a kid in Alabama. It's hard to even conceive of such a thing. I was actually worried that the university was going to be angry because I'd somehow run up a long-distance phone bill. I had no idea how the structure of the internet worked. I'm like, how did the email get from Australia? I'm imagining a dial-up, you know, they had to call the computer. And anyway, I had that all wrong.
My first admission, by the way, is I did a degree in engineering, and I remember very clearly going to the computer science lab, as it was then, and being given something that they described as an email address,
right.
And thinking to myself, I cannot conceive of any possible use for this whatsoever, and sent one in my 4 years at engineering.
That's
so
amazing.
That is slightly shameful. I ended up in advertising, so draw your own conclusions.
Well, yeah, I mean, given how destroyed my inbox is, I sometimes think, what is the point of email? It's ruining my life. Anyway, so that was quite early on, you know, sort of realizing that this could be very powerful. And then as the internet started to grow, this is what I always say about Wikipedia. One of the reasons Wikipedia is so successful is that I think almost everybody, when they first got on the internet and they first realized, hey, we can talk to people, there is this quite utopian thought of, wow, I can learn about the world. People can share knowledge all around the world.
That's very much how the internet was seen. I mean,
yeah.
Wasn't it? It would bring down totalitarian states and all this kind of thing, wasn't it?
In the dot-com boom, it started to feel like it was all pop-up ads and, you know, selling dog food and so forth. And that was when I launched Wikipedia, And I think a lot of people thought,
this is 2000.
2001. Yeah. And I think a lot of people thought, wow, yeah, this is great. Like sharing knowledge, that is what the internet's for. That's what I thought it was about. And now we can do that. So it was very successful and popular. Now, has the internet lived? It has, absolutely. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the internet. I'm a big critic of certain problems that we have right now. And
do you think net the positives outweigh?
Net the positives are enormous. And, you know, the openness, the communication, I have a lot of concerns about censorship, for example, but the internet makes censorship very, very difficult, obviously not impossible.
Is fake news, or at least the institutionalized fake news, where it's not just people, individuals giving their opinion, but is that a form of censorship in the sense that if you just put enough fake stuff out there, it's hard to tell that... It's hard to tell what's real.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, certainly what we are seeing is state-backed disinformation campaigns, which is – I wouldn't call it censorship exactly because that's a particular concept, but it's in that realm of misleading people, confusing people, you know, flood the zone with so much nonsense that it's hard for people to even know what's going on, what's true or not. I mean, my example of this is most recently is – maybe Ukraine is the one who hacked those servers. It's like, no, like literally no. There's zero evidence of that. And just saying it 1,000 times doesn't make it something that's actually true. But saying it 1,000 times means a lot of people who aren't sort of digging in and paying attention are thinking, oh, I can't. There was some scandal. I don't know. Was it Ukraine hacked the servers or were the Russians? I mean,
I find myself doing that increasingly now. Even when I see a photograph now, if I see it on a social media platform, I will... particularly if it's a photograph being, look at this, or wow, can you believe this person did this?
Yeah.
I will try and find out where that photograph came from.
But one of the things
made me sort of at least question more, which maybe is a good thing.
Yeah, I think it is. I think if we all step back and say, what is the information we're receiving and where does it come from? Is it quality? This is something I think should be taught in schools in a much more aggressive way than it ever had to be in the past. Because in the past, the range of information sources open to you was fairly narrow compared to today. Today, you know, if you want to know about coronavirus, right, you can get everything from crank crazy people blogs, rumors on Twitter, to serious sort of thoughtful things from official agencies, to actually – and also this is a funny way of thinking about it, but I was looking at an academic – medical journal, a scientific paper about sequencing coronavirus. And I was reading it and I thought, this is actually potentially misinforming because I literally have no idea what I'm reading. I'm not an expert in this. Like, I could take one sentence here and misunderstand it and come away with the belief. So I actually don't need to read the direct scientific literature. I need somebody who does
to intermediate it, to explain it
to me.
And the question then is, who do you trust to do that, I suppose?
Yeah.
Where do you find those people?
You know, one of the things I find very interesting is when we look at the Edelman Trust Barometer survey, which they've been doing every year for a long time, that in the most recent survey, it's still the case that the most trusted group in society is scientists. And that's really good news.
Encouraging.
Given that amount of science skepticism that we see, given, you know, the anti-vaxxers and I was really happy to see the head of
climate
the NHS
change,
complain about Goop the other day. I'm like, great. Yeah, climate change is not, you know, all of these things. But people still do trust scientists. And I do think I'm quite old-fashioned in a way about that sort of thing. Who do I trust? I trust thoughtful experts.
Yes, me too. You know? I'm exactly the opposite. I'm absolutely not fed up of experts. I love hearing from experts.
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually quite invigorating.
Exactly. And it's a funny time in history.
As well as a company leader, you genuinely are a thought leader. What gives you your sense of achievement?
A lot of things. I mean, certainly I'm quite proud of Wikipedia and what the Wikipedia community has accomplished. You know, some meaningful moments for me are, you know, times I like when I'm traveling, I like to visit schools in the developing world because I'm really interested in education and what's going on there. And when I meet young people in a very poor area, but they've all got a mobile phone and they all know Wikipedia because they use it for their homework and they don't have, you know, the school doesn't have any books in the library, you know, it's that sort of thing. And realizing like, wow, this is actually impacting people's lives in a positive way, that they're able to learn what they want to know. I mean, that's a fantastic thing. I mean, it's a really wonderful piece of it. So that gives me a sense of achievement.
Do you feel it also comes with a heavy responsibility for you personally?
Yeah, definitely.
Or do you feel sits with the community, or do you sort of share it with the community?
I'm part of the community, so I feel it. You know, I think we should feel it. We do feel it. You know, when you're part of the infrastructure of the world in the way that we are, we do have a heavy responsibility to get it right, to do the best we can. Obviously, Wikipedia has errors. It will always have errors. Doing quality reference material is really, really hard, and mistakes will be made. But you particularly see, and I actually haven't looked this up, but I can guarantee you, if you go, well, there's a page online, you can look up the traffic to Wikipedia pages. Our traffic about coronavirus has gone through the roof. And that is because people are typing it into search engines, and then they're going down the list, and they're going to click on Wikipedia because they trust Wikipedia. They know, of course, it isn't perfect and so forth, but they also know that it's honest. And that it's calm, and that it's going to be fact-based. And so then you say, well, the people who are working on that, they have a heavy responsibility.
I'm intrigued as to your role as a leader and a founder, and I suppose as a figurehead, with all of your ventures. I mean, they are obviously very, very heavily community-driven.
Very.
They are. I mean, they are founded in the principles of a community. Yeah. You look at it sometimes and think, oh, we're, you know, this bit's getting away from us, so we need to change our procedures.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely times when, you know, I say, look, we need to find a solution here. One of the issues we have is it's become very hard to become an administrator. And people agree it should be easier to become an administrator. Now there's five different proposals for how to do that, and none of them has majority support, and therefore we're stuck, and we've been stuck for a couple of years at least, you know. And I was like, yeah, okay, I know that feeling, right? And so you have to sort of go through some sort of a process to get consensus.
And ultimately, do challenges like that, ultimately, do they end up on your desk or your, I don't know, your mobile phone?
Not really. I mean, not anymore. No, I don't get involved in day-to-day policy, but I weigh in from time to time, and people do listen, so I have influence there. But that's always been the case, right? It's the nature of a community of volunteers. You can't boss people around and tell them what to do, because they'll just go, no, I'm not going to do that, and that's that. So you have to bring people on board, which, by the way, I believe is actually, you know, when I speak to businesses and about leadership, I say, you know what, that's actually true in businesses as well, right? If you think, I'm going to tell people what to do and they have to do it because I pay them, you're going to be sorely disappointed, because unless people genuinely want to do the thing and they genuine buy-in, yeah, they'll probably do it because they don't want to get fired, but they're not going to be happy. They're going to leave as soon as they can, or they're going to do what you're demanding in a half-hearted way.
I mean, that's certainly my view and belief is that the if you like, the top-down management style, which is, I think, what you're command and control, let's say, which is what I think you're describing.
Yes.
I think maybe that worked once. I don't know. But I certainly think it doesn't work now.
No. I mean, I think it only ever worked in sort of the worst of situations where it's, you know, your job is to stand here by a machine and turn that screw. And you need to do this many per hour, and you can only take breaks here and there. And it just doesn't really work in any kind of employment that involves human creativity and thinking, which, by the way, everything does.
Yeah, everything does.
And so, you know, that trusting people, training them so they have the capacity to deal with whatever comes up, and then trusting them to just deal with it is the only way.
The way I think and talk about that is I think that is fundamentally about organizational culture. It's creating an environment where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the lessons from the Wikipedia world is that talent is much more widely distributed in society than people might have originally thought. Truth is, lots of people are polymaths. They have lots of different interests and they're lots of different talents. And young or old, you know, they're able to dig deep and do something.
Has failure played a role in your success?
Definitely, definitely. In fact, I often, if I'm asked to speak to entrepreneurs, and particularly young entrepreneurs, I always come in and say, oh, well, here I am, and you think I'm going to tell you an inspirational story of my success, but I'm actually going to just tell you about all my failures.
People love hearing about failures.
Yeah, and I actually think it's more interesting. It's more important. It certainly helps you understand how I got where I am. You know, like the tagline in the speech is failure, Jimmy Wales is good at it. And, you know, it is true. And it's actually, you know, it's when I start something new now, it's both a lot easier for me and in a certain psychological way, a lot harder. And this is what I tell young entrepreneurs. I'm like, go out, try your thing and fail. And guess what? If it fails, nobody's even going to know. Literally nobody's paying attention to you. If I go out and fail, everybody's like, and that's great. I'm over it. Like, I don't care.
What's the biggest or most important lesson failure's taught you?
I've learned a lot of lessons. You know, things like, I mean, you jokingly said in the intro that I invented Deliveroo before Deliveroo, but I did try to do a online food ordering business. And that one, it was just too early. Like, people didn't know what the hell I was talking about. And, you know, in 1996, restaurant owners in particular were like, what, you mean a fax machine? Like, they don't even know what the web is or the internet. So here's what I say to young entrepreneurs. Like, first of all, when things aren't going well, you have to be willing to persist and push through and solve those problems. And people may doubt you. They may not agree. And you just have to push through and make it happen. Also, you need to realize when something's not working that you need to radically pivot and change. The problem is these are completely contradictory bits of advice, right? So you hit a problem and you think, should I stop doing this and go to something completely different, or should I push through? And that's the art of entrepreneurship, really, is learning over time to recognize as fast as you can, hey, this is not working because I need to tweak this, that, and the other, or this is fundamentally a bad idea. This is never going to work and I need to change completely. And you never know. Like, that's the, in some ways, that's the joy of entrepreneurship, but it's also the pain of entrepreneurship.
I mean, by any measure, you've been incredibly successful. And what do you think your greatest strengths are?
I'm a very friendly person.
A very
friendly.
Friendly person.
Friendly person, yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting because you're reading about different business leaders. People can be successful with very different styles.
For sure.
And so you've got sort of legendary, the Steve Jobs, kind of a tyrant, right? But a creative genius, and bullies people through things and pushes them hard to achieve more than they ever could have. And that's a style that's totally not me. I can't do that. I'm just not that type of person. And my approach is much more friendly. Like, I'm just like, I like people and, you know, like, let's have some fun and let's try something interesting and so on. And so, and that's not a perfect leadership style. You know, it's got its problems. I'm very bad at firing people who need to be fired because I'm just too nice. And I just think, you know, well, let's try and figure out how to, what can this person do? How can we improve and so on, which is good in a way, but you can go too far with it. So that's a weakness of mine.
Do you think you're just not afraid of failing? Or does it just not enter your head? Is that just not an equation you consider?
You have to consider it a bit, and you have to be, I mean, you're a little afraid. There was a story in Wired about Wiki Tribune when I was in the middle of a pivot. So the old model wasn't working. I laid off all the journalists, and the headline, like, he was going to save journalism. He failed, right? I think the exact quote. But I'm like, well, that's actually ouch, right? And by the way, you got all the facts wrong. We didn't fire all the staff, only the journalists.
Fake news.
You know, fake news. But, you know, those kinds of things, you know, like, people say to me, are you nervous when you get up to give a speech? I give speeches a lot. That, no, zero, not at all. And, I mean, there is a part of me that just, in my mind, there's a piece that says, I don't care what you think of me, right? Because go fuck yourself. I invented Wikipedia, so I'm happy, right? I don't feel I've not contributed to the world. I don't feel I've not done a good thing. So anything else I want to do now, it's my right to, like, screw things up and do it wrong and fail and whatever. It's a little embarrassing when a failure happens, but it's really more about saying, you know what? Actually, if you want to innovate, unless you're on the brink of failure in some sense, you're probably not actually innovating, right? You're not trying something new, because if you're trying something new and untested, obviously you're going to get it wrong sometimes. You'll get it right sometimes as well. I always say this about the money question. I live here in London, and the number of bankers in the city right here who make far more money than I ever will, right, is huge. I have no idea. There's lots of them and they're very wealthy, right? And I'm like, I wouldn't trade with any of them for a second because, I mean, my life is so interesting. I can go anywhere and see anybody. And if I go to a country and I want to meet the president, I just, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, the Wikipedia guy, I'll meet him. That's amazing. Like, what a treat in life to know that I can do whatever I want in that sense, not on my own jet, right? You know, you can buy plane tickets.
you mentioned earlier there was a story behind the Nearly Deliveroo. What is that?
Yeah, so I did, it was exactly, you know, what I was saying. Like, I set up a business like quite early on the internet, and I was working in downtown Chicago, and we were, you know, people order lunch out and you had to fax in your order or call, and a lot of mistakes and all that. And I knew, like, I'm on the internet. I'm like, this is obviously going to move on the internet, that you'll be able to go on a website and order food from anywhere you want and have it delivered. And so I built the website and sort of got a system for putting menus in. It was all very primitive and so on. And then I went out to local restaurants. I literally couldn't convince them to sign up. They were just like, I literally have no idea what you're talking about. Order food on the internet, like that, what, like, I can't even understand that. So I was like, okay, that didn't work.
There you go. Maybe every idea has its time.
Every idea has its time. And actually, this is another thing I talk about to young entrepreneurs, and actually also to policymakers, and sort of a cultural point. One of the fantastic things about the Silicon Valley culture, which has its flaws, of course, but one of the great things about it is the idea that if you try a startup and it fails, that doesn't mean your career is over and that you're a loser. And in fact, what it probably means is you're too early, you're too late. You know, there's always reasons. And if you learned from it, then you're likely to get a second backing, or you're going to get a fantastic job at Google or something like that. And in a lot of cultures, particularly in the East, actually continental Europe is not perfect in this regard. There is this sense that if you try to do a startup and you fail, it's going to be shameful and you're probably going to damage your job prospects in the future and so on and so forth. And certainly anybody in a position of power, like if you're hiring someone at a big company in Paris, I hope nobody looks at a failed entrepreneur and says, failed, right? I hope they say, oh, that's super interesting, right? I've got all these other sort of people who've never tried anything in their life.
I agree with that entirely. I think timing is interesting as well. I heard somebody talking about 4G and 5G, and an idea is relevant to the technology context that it's launched in as well. So 4G enabled Uber. Uber couldn't have existed with 3G.
Yeah.
And I think it's an interesting conversation now, which is, what will 5G enable?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's somebody's had a Deliveroo type idea that's died that will thrive once 5G comes along.
I think that's exactly right. You know, sometimes people ask me, what do you think the next big thing in tech is going to be?
That's nearly my next question.
And I always say, look, I'm an entrepreneur, so if I knew that, I'd start building it.
My final question then. So you nearly touched on this, but what next for you?
I'm 100% focused right now on WT Social, so Wiki Tribune Social. If people like my ideas and they've heard this, please come and sign up. Please pay if you want to, but you don't have to. I just think we can build something new and different in the area of social media that will help save journalism and therefore help save the world.
Jimmy Wells, thank you very, very much for your time.
Thank you. Yeah, great to be here.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Please take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.